dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. One of the heroes and champions in that war, by my estimation, is our first guest. He is Congressman Mike Turner. He represents the people of the 10th District of Ohio in the House of Representatives. He is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee's Tactical Air and Land Forces Subcommittee and a member, formerly the chairman of its Subcommittee on Strategic Forces. Mike, it's always good to have a chance to talk with you. A lot going on in your space, and I'm anxious to get your thoughts on it. Welcome back.
Well, Frank, thanks for having me, and thank you for always highlighting what are really important issues that frequently people are not aware of, and they need this information. It's just, there's a lot at stake.
Well, they do, and you've been showcasing some of it in your early hearings in the TAC Air Subcommittee, and one of the comments that you made and some brief remarks you gave to members of the press, including me yesterday, revealed some of the concerns that General Amos, for example, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, has about where the Marines are at the moment, and presumably the force more generally, as a result of the budget cuts that are now underway and in prospect. Give us a sense of what his take is and what we all should know about it.
Well, this is very important, and I really think this should be getting a lot of attention. Thank you for raising it. The Department of Defense has delivered their budget for this year, but they have ignored really the effects of sequestration, the fact that as a result of the president's failed leadership, these sequestration, these draconian cuts are falling upon the military. So they issued a budget that would be as if those cuts were not there. Even with ignoring sequestration, the Department of Defense has had to drastically reduce its capability. Our national security strategy has been based upon always being able to fight in two contingency operations, assuming that there are two major conflicts that erupt, that we would be able to defend ourselves, because the world obviously is a complex and large place.
And this is presumably designed at least in part to try to deter anybody from trying to take advantage of our preoccupation with a fight in one place by starting another one.
Exactly. Because if we're occupied in one, and people know that we're occupied, we would have a vulnerability if we were not able to be successful in two. The Department of Defense budget, as articulated by the president, has scaled that back to one contingency operation. So then we're now to that vulnerability. We now have to think whether or not we use our military force to protect ourselves, because once it, as you just described, is occupied, we have a vulnerability. So that is a major concession. It's you know, a shift from decades of defense policy that we would be able to maintain our preeminence in two conflicts. So going down to one is risky, and then the fact that they had ignored sequestration raised the issue, which I asked General Amos, coming out of the Marines, if sequestration goes into effect, which you've ignored in this budget, can you even maintain one contingency operation? And his answer was no. He gave the requirement level of what he would need to be able to do one major contingency operation, and he said sequestration takes him below that level. So this is striking, but here we are in Washington, and as you know, I voted against this mess of sequestration. We have the administration taking no action to offset sequestration that renders our military unable to fight in one major contingency operation.
Yeah, and Congressman Mike Turner, I guess the point is, against the backdrop of what's been developing this week with an attack of some kind up in Boston, a terrorist attack for sure, its provenance not yet determined, and now what seems to have been a ricin attack on at least one Senate office, it's a reminder that the world is a dangerous place, and our ability to project power is going to be more needed in almost all likelihoods ever more in the future. And in that regard, very quickly, I just would like to get your initial thoughts as the new chairman of the Tactical Air and Land Forces Subcommittee of the House Armed Services Committee, Mike Turner, about the key decisions that are before your subcommittee and the committee more generally in terms of modernizing our forces. Can that be done in these budget-constrained environments?
Well, not with sequestration, but even beyond that, we're concerned that the decreased funding for the Department of Defense will put us at a great disadvantage as we seek both in the Army and the Air Force to modernize. And we have to modernize. We have decades-old equipment that also has been through two conflicts that the many conflicts, we've had what we've called a peace dividend. This is not an era of a peace dividend. Although we're scaling back in Iraq and Afghanistan, the world is not becoming a safer place. We've got North Korea beating the war drum. We have to make certain, as we look to both what China and Russia is doing, that we keep pace and that we not have vulnerability, because we know whenever we have weakness, that puts our freedoms at risk.
It does indeed. And has been pointed out, it often inspires aggression on the part of others. Congressman Mike Turner of the 10th District of Ohio, let me ask you about another issue that touches on some of those concerns that you've just expressed about the Russians and the Chinese particularly, and North Korea. You've written yesterday to the president a letter very strongly objecting to some of the decisions that have now been announced to further muddle or even weaken our missile defense capabilities. What is going on that front, and what should we be doing instead?
This is very scary. When the Bush administration departed, they had placed us on a path of being able to defend the homeland with missile defense technology that we had that was tested and could protect the United States from an ICBM attack from either Iran and North Korea, recognizing that they were emerging threats. This administration came in, slashed the Bush administration budget, set aside the programs that were going into place that would protect our homeland, and announced their new initiatives, which a half a decade later, they are now abandoning. So the programs that were on the books and in place that would be being installed to protect the homeland, they killed their programs that they supplanted them with, they've now killed. So we're left with, the Bush administration's plans from 6 years ago as our only infrastructure for defending ourselves.
It's gotten a little confusing, Congressman Turner, because, of course, they added back some of the ground-based interceptors that they had previously said they were going to cut in Alaska. Does that offset the reductions that they've made with respect to the so-called SM-3 Block 2B in Europe?
Absolutely not. The whole concept of really any missile defense strategy is to have a shoot-look-shoot capability, the ability to shoot at an incoming missile, take it out, determine whether or not you've taken it out, and shoot again if you've not. Because you have no more
layered defense.
You have an ICBM coming in with a nuclear warhead. You have no margin of error here. You have to have the ability to protect yourself. And that has a deterrence effect also. If you do have an ability to knock it out of the sky, they're less likely to do it because they know that they would be faced with your response without having been able to affect the attack. The concept of the initial plan and even the Obama plan as stated but now abandoned was to have a forward basing in the European area to protect us for the first shot against Iran, a second shot coming out of Alaska, and then similarly, we would have that capability in California, Alaska, looking to North Korea, and then perhaps the addition of assets in the Japanese and Guam area. As they have downscaled this, we have lost that, and now the Obama administration, which had been abandoning portions of our missile defense system in hopes of engaging the Russians in both talks for reducing nuclear weapons and or for attempts to dissuade Iran, their nuclear program, is now attempting that failed strategy and policy with China. They've now gone to China and said, we'll abandon some of our missile defense assets that have been deployed to the Pacific if you take action to dissuade North Korea.
Yeah, and we've been down this road before. We know that the Chinese are perfectly capable of, and in fact quite proficient at, playing this double game where they encourage these guys to behave badly and then reap war rewards of various kinds from us, including, in this case, perhaps missile defense cuts. Congressman Mike Turner, thank you for staying on this case and for your clarity and leadership in defending our country. It's deeply appreciated. We hope we'll have a chance to talk with you again about all this very soon. Next up, Dr. Daniel Pipes joins us to explore what the devil's going on in the Middle East. Straight ahead.
Michael Medved is not afraid to say what others will not.
There is dysfunction at the heart of Islamic countries. Now, you can say it has nothing to do with true Islam. Okay, fine. That may be true. There were glorious years of Islamic civilization, but not in the last 400. I mean, for goodness sake.
Don't you see it before your eyes?
Is it wrong to point out?
The Michael Medved Show. Weekdays at 3, right before Hugh Hewitt at 6, on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia the Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Diana West, one of our go-to folks on matters involving, well, just about any darn thing, because that's kind of her portfolio and her marvelous blog at dianawest.net and her syndicated columns give her the full run of the public policy arena. And I want to talk to you today, Diana, about several different facets of the issues you've been focusing on. But obviously, we want to get first and foremost your take on both what happened on the 15th of April in Boston and what has happened since that sheds light on at least how we have been approaching these issues, if not on what actually went down. And give us your reading on these attacks, the two bombing incidents that occurred in this in the course of the Boston Marathon.
Yes, the Boston atrocities. Well, I was watching the press conference yesterday in Boston as the government authorities took over the investigation and gave us the first take on it. And I have to say, I was very dispirited. This is our new normal in the eyes of our government. That is my takeaway of the government attitude, that there are better ways to keep us safer, perhaps more cameras, more dogs, more checkpoints. Of course, the kind of triumph of the medical system and the heroics of the crowd are indeed important and of great consoling value to us in a time of crisis. However, I do get the feeling that the government, the authorities who now run this and control the information as best they can about what actually happened, see this as the pivot, see this as the emphasis of how we, quote, go forward. In other words, improve triage, improve security, rather than throbbing with outrage in terms of trying to nail down who did this and address the means to prevent it from happening again.
And you have particularly expressed some concern about the president's response to all of this, the evidence that it offers that this new normal, as you put it, might sound a lot like sort of our left mostly, but not entirely, musing about why they hate us in the aftermath of the 9/11 attack.
Yes. Well, you know, we don't yet know if we can put this in the column of an Islamic attack on the United States. However, the markers are there that certainly bear heavy investigation and emphasis, because, of course, that is the number one suspect that first points comes to mind. And in watching this, again, a reprise of what we've seen before after 9/11, after Madrid, after London, and so on, this kind of rush to see how we could do something to prevent these attacks by changing our behavior, changing our outlook. This is what came to me in the echo of the president's initial response, which was to bring the perpetrators to justice, which for me has been a jarring phrase since 9/11, as though justice is involved here. Rather, I prefer revenge and answering the attack so that it does not come to our shores again.
Yeah, deterring.
However,
it in the
beyond
future.
That, yes, beyond that, there was this very clear call for understanding why these attacks happened, as if terrorists have a logical grievance that can be expressed in the killing of 8-year-old boys and brain damaging his mother and everything else that happened that includes the permanent sundering of civilizational fabric. There is no mending, there is no repair to what happened in our history, in our culture, in our whole civilization with an attack like this on the Boston Marathon, as we've seen in other attacks, pizza parlors, discos, etc. I mean, we are living in a time of chaos and shattering, and this again is where I bristle at the notion that, you know, there's this way of, you know, applauding the fabulous triage as if that is the answer.
Right.
And
Diana West, again, is our guest. She is the author of several books, one just about to come out, one that has been out for some time and is just superb, both of which address kind of this issue of the condition of our culture and where we go from here. The first is The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. And the other, shortly to arrive, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on our nation's character. Diane, let me switch gears a little bit. One of the issues that you've alluded to here, and of course we've had some indication that there is a potentially quite radical Saudi visitor here on a student visa who has at least been held as a person of interest at one point, now a witness that may or may not have had something to do with this affair. But we certainly have seen evidence of the rising prominence and, to some extent, the assistance of the United States government in that prominence of the Muslim Brotherhood, both in this country and elsewhere. Tell us a little bit about this this fellow Hito in Syria, where he came from, and what it suggests that we are now embracing him as the putative prime minister of the opposition there.
Yes, well, this is the new prime minister of the rebel Syria. And he comes right out of the United States wing of the Muslim Brotherhood. And this is something that has been tracked, underscored by reports such as Global Muslim Brotherhood Report and elsewhere that have noted his involvement in various American Muslim Brotherhood fronts. He's been heavily involved in CARE. He has been involved in a school, or rather on a board of a foundation of sorts, or a organizing group of sorts that runs a school in Texas, a school system that among its projects of this foundation are bringing Islamic courts to Texas. I mean, this is essentially someone who is working, you may say, peacefully within the system to advance the entrenchment of Sharia law in Texas, in America. This, one has to always understand, is precisely the goals of very violent terrorists, very violent jihad that is always done, always committed to entrench, to promote, to make normal Sharia, right, wherever it strikes.
The point is that this is an individual who has been working to do that here.
Yes.
Now decided that he's a good guy to try to do it, obviously, in Syria, which raises the specter of yet another nation falling under the sway of, at best, the Muslim Brotherhood, and at worst, Al-Qaeda or others who are even more aggressive, more violent in their efforts to impose this Sharia doctrine upon us. Diana, let me ask you, swinging from Hito to a woman who seems to have been quite influential in American policy with respect to the Muslim Brotherhood. She featured prominently in a piece at the New York Times Magazine this weekend, about which you've also written at dianawest.net. Tell us a little bit about Huma Abedin.
Huma Abedin is former Representative Anthony Weiner's wife. She is also, for many years, a longstanding, very close aide to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And indeed, has also a participant, a member, a involvee, if there is such a word, in very distinctly trackable Muslim Brotherhood activities emanating from a think tank and journal run by her parents in Saudi Arabia, known as the Institute of Muslim Minority Affairs. And she has spent many years, she's a young woman, she's not an old person, but much of her adult life has been spent involved in this institute, in the journal it puts out, which is, again, another vehicle, another sort of intellectual vehicle of promoting Sharia in non-Islamic countries.
Right. The same program Hito was engaged in Texas is part and parcel of her family business.
And the very alarming link, which is just astonishing that this link would still permit her to have such access to the Secretary of State, on the person who had her parents actually start this whole institute some years ago, is someone who has later been identified as an Al-Qaeda financier.
Oh, I'm shocked. Diana, we have to let you go. There's so much more to talk about this.
Yes.
Let's do it again soon.
Okay.
Huma Abedin, not mentioned in any of these respects in the New York Times Magazine, needless to say, but you hear it here at Secure Freedom Radio. Diana, thank you for joining us. We'll talk with you again soon. Hans von Spankowski up next on the Thomas Perez affair. Straight ahead.
to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fastballing philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Explosive packed pressure cookers full of nails and ball bearings in Boston. An envelope laced with a deadly toxin called ricin intercepted on its way to a senator's office in Washington. These attacks may have nothing in common except this. There is evil in the world, and we are in its crosshairs. Our enemies include jihadists who use terror to impose Islam's supremacist Sharia code, to psychopaths who simply want to kill and maim. Evil requires the good, the innocent, and the peaceable to rouse themselves to be vigilant, courageous, strong, and engaged in their common defense. We must put aside the illusion that if only we leave the evil alone, they will do the same to us. It has never been true in the past, and it won't be in the future. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement? And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate, and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Daniel Pipes, one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving the Middle East and Muslim history. He is, of course, the founder of a marvelous organization in Philadelphia, the Middle East Forum, a published author many, many times over, and a man that we turn to for insights on these matters with great appreciation. Dr. Pipes, thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
Talk to me a little bit, if you would, in sort of the macro sense of what makes the Middle East such a dynamic, indeed volatile and dangerous part of the world.
It's hardly the only threat. I mean, look at North Korea these days, China, Russia, Venezuela. But the Middle East presents the most crises. First, there's WMD, weapons of mass destruction, Iran and Syria in particular. Then there's the ideological threat of Islamism, which is everywhere, but particularly prominent in countries like Tunisia, Egypt, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Afghanistan. Then there's a problem which doesn't get much notice, which is anarchy. Middle East is known for its repressive regimes, but those repressive regimes have a tendency to collapse, and one finds anarchy instead. And I can give you a long list of countries over the last 30 years, which have descended at least in part into anarchy. Perhaps the most dramatic of them is Somalia, but also substantial parts of Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, Mali, on and on. Then there's terrorism. We tend to pay the most attention to terrorism against Israel, but the actual largest amounts of numbers of terrorist incidents and fatalities are in Pakistan and then in Iraq as well as in Israel. Egypt is on the verge of potential economic collapse. There's going to be hunger in Egypt unless something dramatic changes.
Yeah, all of these come together in a truly critical mass, as it were. We are talking with Dr. Daniel Pipes. He is just treated us to a very quick and daunting array of problems that are afflicting the Middle East and, as a result, the rest of us. And Dr. Pipes, I want to pick up on something you touched on just at the end there, economic collapse in Egypt. We have been throwing a lot of money at the place since the Muslim Brotherhood took it over. Is that likely to stave this off, or is it simply, in a way, money down the rat hole and the problems are much more systemic and they're for intractable?
Let me just add, not only selling money, but we're selling tear gas to the regime.
140,000 canisters at the last count, right?
I cannot see how the regime is going to find its way out of the economic problems it has. Every single source of income is down, and expenses are up. And the regime is totally focused on solidifying its grasp on power and is paying almost no attention to the economic.
You mentioned in particular some stunning statistics yesterday in the lecture, the Henry Jackson John Kyle lecture, Dr. Pipes, about the food crisis that is confronting. This was a country that, with the fabulous resource of the Nile, used to be a breadbasket. What's happened?
Gamal Abdel Nasser happened in the 50s and 60s. Changed the agricultural system, and now Egypt imports, in absolute terms, more food than any other country, and in relative terms, imports more than half of the caloric intake. So Egyptians cannot feed themselves, and they need hard currency to buy wheat, fava beans, and other staples on the world market, and they don't have the money.
And as a result, there is likely to be a further stressing of the system. The Muslim Brotherhood, as you were suggesting, is keen to exercise fully the control that it finally has obtained. Where does this likely lead them? Does it cause them to lash out, or is it a descent into anarchy there as well?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I can't answer it, but I think those are the two main alternatives. One is that the regime uses the economic travails as an excuse to crack down harder and succeeds in doing it, and the other is that revolts occur and it's pushed out of power and one has at least pockets of anarchy. In a country, Egypt, which has historically not known anarchy, historically Egypt is known for central government rule, it's very strong, but we already see the incipient beginning of it with Port Said, which is in rebellion against the central government.
We are talking with Dr. Daniel Pipes of the Middle East Forum. He's the publisher also there of its marvelous publication, The Middle East Quarterly. And over the years, Dr. Pipes, you have written personally about and published others on a very important sort of microcosm of this phenomenon you've described, and sort of showcase for what is going on with respect to American policy at the moment, namely Turkey. Tell us what's happening there and what it means not just for the Turks, but for the region and for us.
Well, Turkey historically, in the 20th century, was the most Western-oriented Muslim country, the best ally of the United States among the Muslim countries, and yet in 2002 had a dramatic change in an election and has turned away. American policymakers, as well as other policymakers, have not recognized this and continue to try and treat Turkey as it was of old. And yet the Turks are having joint exercises with the Chinese, playing footsie with the Iranians, and so forth. President Obama literally hugs the Prime Minister of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and there is a blindness.
His best foreign friend, I'm told, considers him to be.
Yeah, exactly.
A blindness indeed. And I guess one of the key points you made in the Jackson Kyle lecture yesterday, which will be available shortly at securefreedom.org, is the degree to which we're dealing in the Islamists of Turkey with a more cunning and skillful adversary than perhaps in the Muslim Brotherhood's practice elsewhere.
Yes, the Islamist movement has been undergoing some dramatic changes. What began as violent and brutal has evolved, in part, into something much more sophisticated, political, gradual, and consensual. Now, that might sound like good news, but in fact, I don't think it is. It is much easier to fight a Bin Laden than it is an Erdogan. Erdogan is sophisticated and democratic and building the economy. And yet, in the end, he seeks the same goals as a Bin Laden. So,
very troubling indeed. A worrying adversary, to be sure. Dr. Pipes, let me close with something you've written about recently, a provocative piece about Syria. And actually, it had the title of Support Assad. You were clear in your comments yesterday that it's a more nuanced recommendation there. Tell us quickly, if you would, a minute and a half, what your thoughts are on Syria at the moment.
We have two malign forces going at each other. The Assad government, which is horrific, and the rebel forces, which in general are Islamist and also horrific. I don't want either side to win. I think we're better off having Hamas fight Hezbollah, having Iranian-backed Islamists fighting Turkish-backed Islamists, than either side winning and turning against us, turning against our allies. So I take a balance of power approach, divide and conquer approach, which is let them fight each other. And if Assad is losing, which it appears to be, let's support him. If he's winning, let's support the rebels. Let neither side lose, let neither side win.
Yeah, and if he is not either winning or losing, stay the hell out of it, I guess.
Exactly.
Well, it seems like a sensible enough approach. I know that it has prompted some controversy because of the odiousness of the Assad regime, and few have been more clear about what a horrific government it is than you, Dr. Daniel Pipes. So I know this is a very thoughtful and, I think, important contribution to the debate we ought to be having about our policy towards this very problematic nation and, indeed, towards the region. Daniel Pipes, thank you again for joining us, for talking us through what is a most important and dynamic part of the world at the moment, and one that I think we're not doing a particularly good job of managing. We'll look forward to visiting with you again very soon about it. Next up, we'll be speaking with Michael Turner, member of Congress, about strategic forces and missile defense and much more. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
The ambassador of civil discourse, Dennis Prager.
That
A liberal does not recognize that there is a secular left brainwash
at virtually every university in the United States.
I've said this probably 1,000 times. I don't mind that the New York Times is left. I mind that there are people who deny it's left.
The Dennis Prager Show, weekdays at noon, right before Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Mike Gallagher doesn't apologize for speaking the truth.
People are not economically equal. They never have been.
They never will be.
But we believe in giving people the opportunity to try to become financially successful.
How are you going to make a janitor economically equal to a CEO?
But that's what this fierce liberal mindset tries to suggest. And then everybody's happy. Right?
Right.
Wrong.
The Mike Gallagher Show. Weekdays from 9 to noon on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Hans von Spakovsky. He is a senior legal fellow and manages the Civil Justice Reform Initiative at the highly regarded Heritage Foundation. He is in the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies there, a man we both regard very, very highly. He is a former senior official in the Department of Justice, where he served as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, which is particularly important because at the moment, the man who is the incumbent in that position as Assistant Attorney General of the United States for Civil Rights, Thomas Perez, has been nominated by the President of the United States to become the next Secretary of Labor, and tomorrow will be up before the United States Senate for his confirmation hearing. On the eve of that vote, Hans von Spakovsky has contributed not once but twice in important ways to the Senate's understanding of this problem, first in testimony that he gave yesterday before the House Judiciary Committee. We'll be talking about that with him momentarily. And then in a video of what we call a virtual press conference that was made available today at the Center for Security Policy's website, securefreedom.org. Hans, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's terrific to have you with us. Congratulations on some very important work in the past couple of days on this very troubled nomination.
Well, thanks. Thanks a lot, Frank. It's always great to talk to you.
You testified yesterday before the Judiciary Committee that there is a really serious problem inside the Civil Rights Division that Thomas Perez has been responsible for the past 4 years. You describe it as a rampant mismanagement and a toxic culture. Tell us about that and how your words of warning were received by members of the Judiciary Committee yesterday.
Well, what exists inside the Civil Rights Division, which is responsible for enforcing all of our federal anti-discrimination laws, is this culture where any employee that's perceived to be conservative, that's perceived to be a Republican, or anyone who believes in the race-neutral enforcement, for example, of federal voting rights laws, the IG report describes them being harassed, intimidated, bullied, even threatened with physical violence by the other employees there, most of which are, you know, very liberal in ideology. And in fact, Thomas Perez has done nothing to stop that. There are people who bragged the IG, for example, about engaging in cyberbullying of conservative employees, you know, posting nasty comments on liberal websites, so forth. They've been neither disciplined, they haven't been terminated, and that is the reigning culture there.
Would you say, Hans, that this is really something that is being not only condoned by Thomas Perez, but is kind of the culture that he's fostering more actively as well?
Oh, it is. And what the evidence of that is in the IG report. There's a chapter there about how this administration drove out the chief of the voting section. This is a longtime career guy. And why did they drive him out? Why? Because during the Bush administration, he was the lead lawyer in the first case ever filed by the Justice Department against local black officials for voting discrimination against white voters. They were so against that when they came in, they did everything they could to drive him out of that job because, as he said himself, that is Perez to the IG, he does not believe that Section 5, which is another part of the Voting Rights Act, he said it doesn't protect white voters from discrimination.
What? You mean me that there's some people have civil rights in this country and other people don't, according to Thomas Perez?
That is exactly right. And I mean, there's just so much more. I mean, there's so much more in that report, all of which, by the way, the Democratic members of the House Judiciary Committee yesterday just wanted to ignore. Their description of the IG report read like a fictional bestseller on the New York Times list. It had no connection to the reality of what was in the report.
Now, again, for our listeners, the IG report to which you refer is a formal Inspector General of the Department of Justice investigation into Thomas Perez's organization under his watch. And the bottom line on that, before we turn to another report, Hans, was that there was, in fact, evidence of wrongdoing. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for example, Perez testified before the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights when it was looking at the dismissal of the new Black Panther Party voter intimidation case. I'm sure your listeners remember that case.
Oh, yeah.
Video of the guys in Philadelphia standing in front of the polling place.
With batons and in a very threatening fashion and actually saying things to voters that was designed to be clearly intimidating. Go ahead.
Perez testified in front of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and he was asked whether any of the Obama political appointees have been involved in the dismissal of that lawsuit. He said no. Well, we now know that it's not true, that in fact senior political appointees within the Justice Department were involved in getting that case dismissed. And, by the way, he was asked, do you know about this hostility to race-neutral enforcement of the law? He said, there's no one of that ilk in my division, which we now know is an absolutely untrue. And one of the other witnesses there at the hearing yesterday, Christian Adams, said that he, in fact, briefed Perez the day before his testimony about that hostile attitude.
Wow. Let me turn quickly, and again, our guest is Hans von Spakovsky. He was formerly a counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, not Thomas Perez, but his predecessor in the Justice Department. He is now with the Heritage Foundation, where he is a senior legal fellow. He just testified yesterday. One of the other developments, I guess the day before yesterday, was the report by the Governmental Reform Committee, Daryl Issa's committee in the House. What were its findings, Hans, and how do they reinforce or in any way otherwise reflect on this nomination from the point of view of your concerns?
Perez did something else, too, that I think, quite frankly, is unethical, and it cost the American taxpayer upwards of $200 million. The Justice Department had a potential case against the city of St. Paul for fraud. And, I mean, a strong fraud case. They falsely certified that they were using federal grant money to help low-income individuals when, in fact, they weren't doing it. Perez talked the civil division, which was pursuing that case, into dismissing the case, a $200 million claim. And why? Because in exchange for that, he got St. Paul to dismiss a case that they had before the U.S. Supreme Court, a case in which the U.S. government was not even a party, because he was afraid that the government, that the Supreme Court was going to toss out this totally bogus legal theory that he has been actually using, Perez, to extort huge settlements from mortgage bankers and others. It's called disparate impact. And the argument is that you don't have to show that somebody intentionally discriminated to violate federal law. If they do something that's completely above board, it's not discriminatory, but it affects some groups of people more than others, guess what? You violated federal law. You've discriminated against them.
Hmm. So the Supreme Court might have ruled against him, and on that grounds, he was willing to make this kind of quid pro quo, I guess is the word for it,
yep.
Deal with St. Paul. One of a number of examples of real, I would suggest malfeasance, perhaps malpractice at a minimum, misconduct for sure, by Thomas Perez. And Hans von Spakovsky, you have very helpfully illuminated this series of problems. There are many more, which we discuss again in the virtual press conference now available at securefreedom.org. I commend to everyone the case against Thomas Perez, why the Senate should reject him. Hans, keep up the good work. Let's talk after his hearing tomorrow and see where we go from here. In the meantime, we'll talk to you very soon. We'll talk to the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.